I really do get the best guest. I'm very honored to have this guy in the studio with me. And if I read his whole bio, we would be here for 3 hours. Dr. David Rubin, professor of medicine, section gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition, co-director of a Digestive Diseases Center for the University of Chicago Medicine. And if you talk to anyone about gastroenterology, who knows about it? Not that your average person on the street does, but another doctor, they will know this guy's name. He speaks all over the world, and he's speaking now about a pandemic and speaking about, well, what can we do to avoid the next one? But before we get there, Dr. Rubin, where are we now? Around the world, I think over 266 million people infected, over 5 million people dead. I mean, even those who expected something to happen, and a lot of people did, maybe you're among them, not surprised by what's going on, especially that it happens to be a coronavirus, would you have thought it would have been this impactful?
Well, hey, Steve, thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here. I'm not happy to have to talk about this topic continuously, but this is really important. Worldwide, what we're seeing now and what's been reported is that the Omicron variant accounts for 98% of the infections we're seeing in most places, including the United States. This is now what we're calling the fifth wave of COVID-19. And whether we thought this is what was going to happen, if you look in the history of pandemics, go back to the Spanish flu or other historical accounts, they always come in waves. And part of that has to do with the changes in the population, the spreading of the virus, and also what viruses do, which is they mutate. Their one function is to figure out how to reproduce. So they're constantly acquiring mutations that either enable it to continue in that regard in some new way, and many mutations which don't do that. But the ones we see, of course, are the ones that make it more virulent.
Mm-hmm. But Omicron hasn't been as virulent as, for example, the last variation of this virus, Delta. Is that a good sign? Has it, for lack of a better term, but it's a term you guys are using now, I think, humanized?
Well, the first thing is to try to cut through some of the confusion, because there's a lot of different messages out there. Omicron is more contagious than Delta and the original variant of SARS-CoV-2.
In fact, it's one of the most contagious viruses, I guess, ever.
Right. So they use something called the R-naught, which is a number that epidemiologists, public health officials, infectious disease experts use. It means if one person is infected, how many people around them could be infected. And the R-naught of the original virus was about 2 to 3. One person would infect 2 to 3 people around them. Measles has an R-naught of 18. Mm-hmm. Hugely infectious. And the estimates for Omicron are between 5 and 10. So it's much more infectious than the original one we saw. So that's the first part. The second piece, which you were mentioning, is how sick do people get who get Omicron? And that's a hard thing to measure because in part what we're measuring and seeing has to do with how many people are vaccinated. And thankfully, the vaccines have reduced the serious illnesses, deaths, and hospitalizations.
But is that really true? I mean, there are people, by the way, 312-981-7200. You can call or text 312-981-7200 if you have any questions for Dr. Rubin. I mean, there are naysayers that say, it's just going to be like a cold. I'm not vaccinated. I'm not going to get vaccinated. If I made it this far, why now?
Well, there's a few different ways to talk about this, and I certainly hear this all the time when I see patients in the office and when I've been educating others, including my colleagues. One of the issues has to do with what happens to the individual person. If you get Omicron as a healthy person, what is your risk for getting really sick, ending up in the hospital, or having a worse outcome? And the second issue really has to do with what's going on in society and all the other people who might have higher risks for getting sick than you do. So we think about what are we doing to protect ourselves and our family members, and what are we doing as a society to address this? And those are two different things in many situations. But we really do need to think about both in order to understand this. There is no doubt that the vaccines that are available have reduced deaths from SARS-CoV-2, from COVID-19. And there's no doubt, based on what we understand so far, that this has reduced the overall serious illnesses we're seeing. if we took just the University of Chicago as an example, or we look at other data sources around the country, we know that although we have the most people hospitalized right now with COVID-19, thankfully, we have less people dying. But we also know that the people in the hospitals are the majority of which are unvaccinated. So we don't want anyone to be in the hospital. And then there's the other part of this is that all the folks who need hospitalization or medical care who don't have COVID are unable to get the access they need. And something that I'm passionate about and I've been speaking about as well is that the healthcare workforce is getting burned out. You know, we're going to burn through an entire generation of healthcare workers because we don't have the resources to continue to support all this. So we have to think about bigger pictures, not just one person at a time. It's hard.
Yeah. Several people are texting this question, and when we come back, I'll let you address it. Are we close to herd immunity? In fact, I want you to explain what herd immunity even is, because I think sometimes it's misunderstood or even not understood, and maybe there's a better term anyway called community immunity. We'll talk about that and much more when we come back with Dr. David Rubin on WGN. Dr. David Rubin is a long title, Professor of Medicine, Chief Section of Gastroenterology, Hepatology and Nutrition, Co-Director of Digestive Diseases Center at the University of Chicago Medicine, speaks all over the world, teaching other doctors about, well, the sort of thing we're talking about right now and answering your questions. 312-981-7200, you can call or text. When we went to the commercial break, Dr. Rubin, and thank you once again for being here on a Sunday, giving up part of your Sunday and coming down into the studio. But look, you get a beautiful view, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, yes. So, the question is about herd immunity. Do we have it? Are we close to it? But even before you answer, what is it really and what is it not? And I prefer maybe community immunity because it may better describe it.
Well, the point of that has to do with if enough people are immune so that the virus is unable to find uninfected, unprotected hosts, the virus will peter out. So the reason we don't see measles much anymore, although it had a resurgence a few years ago due to unvaccinated individuals, is because enough people were vaccinated against measles that the virus had nowhere to go, so it goes away from the population. The concept of herd immunity means that enough people are immune or who have been infected that are still alive that are going to have the same effect.
I think the term actually comes from veterinary medicine and originated, a lot of things do, and originated with cattle.
I'm sure, well, the herd, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the question people want to know is if so many people are getting infected by Omicron now, will we achieve some threshold where the virus will die out and therefore those who are unvaccinated or those who are not protecting themselves in other ways will become immune from exposures and therefore will start to see this go away? And that's, of course, one of the ways we would hope this would happen. In the early days of the pandemic, that was not achievable because the death rates were so high. We were just not making a dent into this. So we didn't have the vaccines, of course, but we also didn't have all the therapies that are now available when people get sick. And although there's a shortage of some of them, they're working to make that more available. And I think that that's going to give us a new leg up when we have people who are at particular risk or who are getting quite ill. And that's a very important piece to this. And
are you happy with the antivirals out there, or are we not there yet? Because I believe, first of all, I don't know how available the new ones are. So if they're there, but they're not really there, they're not available, that doesn't help much. And secondly, the newer ones, as I understand it, have interactions with some very common drugs that, unfortunately, but realistically, most Americans may take.
Yeah, it's a bit complex still. There are several that are oral that you take between 5 days, and some of them require 30 days of treatment. And there are some that are IV or intramuscular, and therefore it's a bit complicated to know who can get what. And as you mentioned, there's a shortage. So right now at our institution and at others, we're limiting it to the people who are at highest risk or who are sickest and who may need these or who can't get vaccinated for other reasons, and we worry about them. But the other piece to this we can't ignore, as much as we want to focus on making sure our community is okay in the U.S. and in Chicago, is the recognition that the rest of the world also needs to get protected, or else we're going to keep going through this cycle of new variants coming and then re-entering the U.S. You know, the world is a very small place now. So even the models of what had been previously predicted for pandemics were off because they didn't realize how quickly things spread now in the world with travel and the shipments of products and other materials all over the world. It takes no time at all, as we saw from the South African Omicron emergence to being in the U.S.
But is there room for another variant? So if another variant pops up, I'm not sure what the next letter is in the Greek alphabet.
Rho.
Okay. That's what we're calling it, all right, officially now. So that
It already exists.
Really?
The question is whether these variants are important or critical or vaccine evading. There's different ways they classify variants.
Or can a variant come in to overcome Omicron?
Right. So the answer is there will be more variants. Fortunately, I want to emphasize that the vaccines we have are actually protecting people against Omicron, as are prior infections. Although you can get reinfected, it appears the immunity you're deriving still works. So we've been fortunate in that regard related to all of this. And I think that's really quite important to keep in mind. Will we have another variant? Yeah, for sure. The question is whether or not it's going to have the impact that we just saw with this. Are we going to enter a sixth wave and then deal with it? But the other part, which is something that you and I chatted about previously, Steve, is that there will be another pandemic in our lifetimes.
What?
The world is smaller. We're forcing animals out of their habitats because of our expansion of populations.
Well, okay, so I want to stop you there because people are thinking, okay, we're forcing animals out of our habitats. That's what I was talking about with the people that I was talking about Betty White and her concerns were. What does that have to do with this?
Well, what happens when you change the habitat of where animals live or where other organisms live and they no longer can breed where they are, then it's survival of the fittest. And so the organisms that live within their hosts will look for other hosts to inhabit. And this concept of viruses jumping from animals to humans and back and forth is not new. That happens with the common cold. That has, we believe, happened with COVID-19. And we know there's some evidence that Omicron may have come from mice, that the SARS-CoV-2 went from humans into mice where it became mutated and then came back to humans. So we have to acknowledge that this is going to keep happening and we have to be prepared and develop some ways to understand it.
Now, I know that you have a lot of bullet points as to what we should do right now to plan for the next pandemic. Would at the top of your list be to stop politicizing what is a medical issue, what is a public health issue? I don't care what your politics are. This doesn't seem to me to be a political issue.
One of the points that I'm not the only one making, and of course public health officials and epidemiologists and those who are the scientists behind all this keep emphasizing, is we need to restore faith and understanding in science and in people whose full-time jobs are to help protect society and to understand these things. And in fact, that's not what I do. I'm a gastroenterologist. I take care of people who have conditions called Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. But we all got pulled into this, right? But there are people whose lives are dedicated to public health and the science behind understanding all this. And we need to, as part of our future, understand how to incorporate that and restore people's understanding, faith, and education, frankly, in the science behind public health. And that hasn't been built into our educational systems the way it should be. Our government and healthcare systems and insurance companies haven't emphasized prevention as much as they could. There are many things that I think we could make a difference in, and that's number one on the list.
You know, when all of this began, like everyone else, I was watching television, and the doctors on television were saying, well, it's happening over there in that country, first China, and then many European countries. And then we saw in India, you know, what was going on, and could never happen here. We're never going to run out of equipment. We're not going to have people lined up in the hallways waiting to be treated. We're not going to have people not go to emergency rooms. We're not going to delay surgeries that are elective surgeries ever. Not in America, but all of that did happen.
Right. Well, we exposed and identified all the weaknesses in our system very quickly. And there are those who were saying for years, but not being heard, that this was going to happen, that it was just a matter of time, that the models all predicted it, that we needed to have a response. There needed to be national storages and PPEs saved and available. And the reality is that it wasn't there. This isn't the first time that happened. You could look even back to when HIV emerged, that people said, oh, we've got to take this crisis and learn from it so the next time something occurs, we're ready. But as soon as the crisis ends, people are exhausted. Yeah. They're ready to turn their eye and move on to something else. And that's what many people are talking about planning for the next pandemic are saying right now is let's learn from what we're doing and use some of the energy we have so we can plan ahead.
In 30 seconds, what would be some other bullet points, some other things we can do right now?
Well, there are a few that I think are important. One of them is to make sure that we're addressing some of the other problems that have come out of this, like understanding the impact on people's mental health. The overuse of alcohol that has occurred with all this.
Yeah.
Understanding how the healthcare workforce has been affected, not just in terms of supply of people, but also in their ability to function, their mental health, and supporting them as we move forward. Understanding more about how we can get the access to the underserved and those who have been not had access to vaccines. All the different populations that have been, recipients of COVID in ways that we shouldn't have had happen. We already talked about the importance of building trust, not just in the healthcare system and in public health, but also building trust to end discrimination and bias in our clinical trials so that we have the right people included in future science. And then lastly, of course, our legislative priorities, making sure we have things in place that will help protect us. That doesn't mean always mandates at all. It just means that we got to all be talking and working together.
He sounds smart, doesn't he? He is. Dr. David Rubin, a pleasure to have you here. I will have you back at some point in time. And yes, we could talk about gastroenterology at that point in time. At IBDMD, I believe.
That's right.
That's the handle on Twitter. Dr. Rubin, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Steve. I just want to wish everybody to stay safe and, you know, keep your heads up. And we're going to get through this.
Heads up and mask on?
I think that's right.
Okay, there he goes. Thank you, Dr. Rubin.